What is going on, friends? Welcome to My Weekly Mixtape, a show that takes the classic mixtape approach to building a modern playlist. I'm your host, Brian Colburn. And over the holidays, I was going back and forth with Patreon mixtaper Philip Bergman about HBO's incredible documentary series Music Box. And one of the episodes that came up was Happy and You Know It, which was all about children's music. And he mentioned that a former Toonstyles guest, Lori Berkner, was featured in the documentary. And he brought up the Toonstyles episode we did with Lori about her music and her rise to fame in the kindie scene, or children's music scene, for those of you that are not familiar with that term. And I actually thought about that episode because it had been a while since I'd heard it. So I went back and gave the episode a listen. Now, this is actually a very important episode in my podcasting career because it is the first guest interview that Jay and I did on Toonstyles. This is the first time we brought in a guest for just a pure interview. So there's kind of a piece of history with this episode. And when I clicked play, I actually was preparing myself to cringe because it had been a long time. And I feel like over the years, I've honed my interview style a little bit. But believe it or not, a lot of the topics we talked about are just as relevant today as when we first recorded it. Something I've always tried to do when it comes to sitting down with an artist or a band for an interview, because I want this to be something that people can listen to years down the road and still get a lot of great information out of. And while I do sometimes talk about an upcoming tour or an upcoming album, I try to do it in the context of the career as a whole, because I feel like the This Is Your Life style interview with a musician is fascinating and something that I love diving into with all the guests that I've been lucky and fortunate enough to have through any of the podcasts that I've been a part of. Now, I'm sure there's some of you out there that are wondering, well, my kids are out of the children's music phase, so why should I listen to this episode? This is a fascinating story about how someone made a name for themselves in a genre of music. And a lot of the topics we talk about in this episode can be featured under any genre of music for any style artist. So even if you're a listener without young children, I feel like there's a lot to take away from this discussion, and it's something that I am so glad to be able to bring back and share with everybody once again on the heels of this HBO Max Music Box documentary, Happy and You Know It. And the series as a whole is fantastic, as over the holidays, I was able to check out the Counting Crows edition, which is called Have You Seen Me Lately? And if you're a Counting Crows fan, I highly recommend that one. I recommend this series hands down, hard stop. Even if you're not a fan of the artist, these episodes really dive into some amazing stories that are all music-centric and music-related, and I've gotten a lot of great entertainment, and I've learned a lot of stuff out of it. So be sure to check the series out. But without further ado, if you like what you're hearing on My Weekly Mixtape and you have a suggestion for a future episode, please hit me up, myweeklymixtape@gmail.com. You can hit me up on all the social media sites at My Weekly Mixtape. You can use the contact page at myweeklymixtape.com. Or last but not least, you can join the Mixtaper community at patreon.com/myweeklymixtape. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube, and you'd like to help the show out, please leave a 5-star review or a comment saying what you enjoy about the show. That helps other music fans discover My Weekly Mixtape and spread the word about what I'm trying to do here. And last but not least, if you'd like to check out the back catalog featuring over 160 plus episodes of My Weekly Mixtape, you can do so over at myweeklymixtape.com. All right, so to the parents out there that have probably heard these songs 1 million times over the last week, actually, who am I kidding? 1 million times over the last day, or to the older listeners out there whose kids have grown up and maybe remember these songs from their childhood, or just remember listening to children's music with their kids in general. This episode's for you. Enjoy this sit down with the one and only Lori Berkner. Lori, thank you so, so much for joining us. We're so excited to have you on.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
We were talking a little bit offline before we started the show. I have 5 kids. My oldest just graduated college this weekend. And my middle 2 kids, 13 and 12, and they grew up on you. And my 5-year-old and my 3-year-old know who you are. My son Eric is a huge fan of dinosaurs, and he loves We Are the Dinosaurs as his favorite song. And so we're just really, really excited to bring this aspect of things to kind of the parents out there.
Right. Because one thing that a lot of us as parents deal with is trying to find music that our kids can enjoy that doesn't torture us on very long car rides.
Right.
And one thing from the first time my wife is a 20-year preschool teacher, and she is the one who introduced our children to your music. And I said, wow, I could dig this. The music is catchy, and I know it's aimed for kids, but I don't feel that way. Is that a kind of thing that you get from a lot of parents?
I feel lucky to say yes, that I do. And I think a lot of what I'm thinking about also when I'm writing music is, what would I be happy listening to? You know, I mean, I know a lot of people who do kids' music feel that way as well, but I think there's a real balancing act to figuring out how to do that and still make music that the kids actually also want to listen to, right? So it's finding that intersection. It's, in some ways, it's a very thin intersection, but in other ways, I think because a lot of the things that kids find interesting and relevant can be so universal, it can also be a really wide range, at least in terms of topics and stuff. And then you just kind of have to figure out how the music will connect to both age groups, really.
Now, in learning about your bio and in your upbringing in music, I learned that you lived in Princeton, New Jersey. There must be something in the water for music between Trey Anastasio from Phish, John Popper from Blues Traveler, Chris Barron from the Spin Doctors, and yourself. There must be something going on in Princeton.
I think there was, Trey was not our year, but Chris and Popper were same, like we spent, well, Popper actually came to Princeton High School, I think. I can't remember if he was a sophomore, but anyway, we all graduated together.
Oh my gosh.
What a musical class. Like, I wonder which one of you guys in the yearbook had most likely to musically succeed, because that would be a...
I think mine was something about like laughing too much. I forget.
You can never laugh too much.
No such thing.
So can you talk about how you started performing in children music and how it evolved from playing music that was aimed for adults and kind of how you transitioned into that and how that kind of all came to fruition?
Sure. So, for a while when I graduated from college, I was writing music and kind of playing around Manhattan in cafes and stuff, doing a singer-songwriter thing. And I also, I played and had a band eventually, and I played in some friends' bands. And then I joined a couple different, like, answered an ad on the back of the paper kind of bands, where I joined an all-female cover band for a while. Lois Lane, yeah. Because she don't need no Superman.
No.
So that was a real learning experience for me about going and playing a lot of shows on Long Island that started at 11 at night and ended at 3 or 4 in the morning.
Oh,
and
wow.
And I would drive home like reeking of cigarettes and carry my amp up 3 or 4 flights of stairs, fall on a bed. And at that point I had already been, in my first year out of college, I got a job as a preschool music teacher for just like a part-time thing. And I was, had sort of transformed that into playing birthday parties on the weekends too. So I would be asleep around 6 a.m. and then I would have to be somewhere by 10 to do a kid's birthday party.
Oh my gosh.
And hopefully have showered.
Wow.
So I did that for a while and I learned a lot being in Lois Lane. I played electric mostly in that band, and there was a lot of just figuring out how to be a lead player and how to sing for long periods of time in front of lots of people, or not very many people who weren't very interested. Like that actually wasn't a bad way to get into KISS music. So then what I realized after a while though was, in my day job, I had been writing songs for the kids in the classroom. And that was mostly because it was very hard to find, it was really hard to find music that not only did the kids like, and that I didn't get sick of singing, but that also directed them, that like was also classroom management, because that was my biggest problem. I got this job because I liked kids and I liked playing music, but I didn't have any background as a teacher. So I didn't really understand how to manage a classroom. And one of the things that I realized after talking to my predecessor there was the more that I put into the music to direct them, the easier just everything would be. They would have more fun. They would know what to do. I wouldn't spend my time kind of chasing kids around the room or yelling or, you know, being a disciplinarian or just feeling helpless and hopeless, which I a lot. So once I had started writing the songs, when I was doing these birthday parties on the weekends, people started asking me for the songs I had written to play those songs. And it was, I mean, honestly, just like really felt so good to be able to write music that people wanted to hear. I'd always wanted to do that. I had my own bands doing that, but I would, you know, maybe get 30 people at some dive bar downtown. But this was like, people were actually like coming and saying, "Hey, play Victor Vito," you know, and I thought, okay, so I wrote it for kids, but it seems like the parents kind of like it too. And I liked the songs, otherwise I wouldn't have written them. And it felt like it was the thing to follow. Like I was noticing this is working and my other stuff, like I have to play in a cover band to make any money as a musician unless I'm doing kids music. So maybe I should just be doing more kids music. Maybe that's what I'm better at. And so I left the cover band, left Lois Lane. I still did a little bit of my own stuff. I had a band called Red Onion for a while. Mm-hmm. But eventually I just ended up, the parties kind of morphed into concerts for the kids. And I was recording the music I had written and selling it at a few stores that had kind of took a chance on me. And eventually, like, I mean, it's sort of a longer story, but there were many things beyond that, like where someone heard my music who was starting the Noggin channel that became, you know, was a Nick Jr. owned channel. Mm-hmm. I ended up getting being part of a show, Jack's Big Music Show, because it was crazy things. Like I did a bunch of birthday parties. Someone who had a birthday party. Should I be talking about all this? You want to hear all this?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is fascinating.
Well, someone who went to a birthday party, got one of my CDs, took it home, loved it, happened to be a line producer at the Today Show, went to the executive producer and said, I don't know who it was, but whomever she was supposed to ask about getting someone on.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Said, "Hey, check out this kids music artist. This would be really cool. Why don't you do you could do a thing in the plaza and they could perform and people would come and it would be a really cool segment." And that person said no. And then that person lost their job and a new one came, a new head of whatever came in, and she went and she pitched again. I didn't even know her. And she pitched me again. And this person said, "Oh, I've been to those Upper West Side birthday parties where Lori Berkner plays. Sure, we can have her on this." And I had also done a couple famous people birthday parties, Madonna's kid and Sting's kid. Wow. Also, I know. And I mean, now, well, is she in college? And those parties, same thing. Like I was teaching music on the Upper West Side. Those kids went to classes there. They heard my cassette tape being played in the art room of the West Side Y, where I was also the music teacher, even though I didn't have them in my classes. It was all just sort of people sharing the music. And when I ended up being on the Today Show, I told that to the person who was starting the Noggin channel, which she said, "So talk to me about things that have worked out really well for you. What's been happening in your life?" And I said, well, this was maybe a year later that I was talking to her. I said, a year ago, I got on the Today Show and I started selling all these CDs. Like apparently people went into Barnes and Noble and asked for me all over the country. So Barnes and Noble's distributor called me at home and said, "Hi, is this Two Tomatoes Records? I'm looking for someone named Lori Berkner." And I'm in my bathrobe in my one bedroom apartment going, yeah, you've reached Two Tomatoes Records. How can I help you?
Well, let me put you through. I'm her assistant.
Yeah, but we need to order, you know, we want to start carrying her albums in our stores. But I mean, I couldn't get anybody on the phone before that. I was this Alliance was the name of the distributor at the time. And they didn't even, they had a phone tree that led you to another phone tree. I could never talk to a human being when I tried to. But then when people went and started asking for my music in the stores after the Today Show, right. So then they actually called me at home. So things sort of built up. And when I told the Noggin woman about that, she said, her name was Amy Friedman. She said, "Huh, you were on TV for 15 minutes playing a couple of your songs. and you started, like, people went into stores all over the country looking for them. Why don't we make a few videos with you? And so we did the one that was for Jack's Big Music Show when it was still a pilot. But then I made four other ones with her, and she just started, they started playing them on Noggin. And kind of the same thing happened, only like 10 times bigger, when they started showing those videos of my songs on their channel, which doesn't even exist anymore.
Right.
In app form. But so anyway, there's a lot to the story. I'm sorry to keep going on.
No, that's, believe me, I'm in awe. This is just it's an amazing, like, sheer determination. Just you do what you do, and eventually it just, the right person gets a hold of the message and runs with it.
It's the dream that every musician out there that's writing music thinks of, and you were able to live it in so many different ways. The thing that I find interesting about this was the first time in reading your bio, I saw a word that I didn't actually know existed, and that was kindie rock. There has to be a philosophy behind that name.
I actually think it came more out of people writing about kids' music than actually from the musicians themselves. I know that when I started, that phrase didn't exist yet. And I think it really coincided with the rise of the internet, that people who wrote music for kids were suddenly able to reach a much broader audience. I mean, for me, like that day that I'm going on a tangent, but I'll tell you why in a minute. So the day that I did the Today Show, like on Amazon, which was one of the places that you could buy CDs at the time, right, online, all three of my albums were in the top five best-selling albums on Amazon, not kids, on Amazon, like next to Van Morrison, and I forget who else, like someone was very popular at the moment. And that was just for a few hours that day. But people were suddenly realizing they could purchase music this way. They could distribute music that way. I didn't have to get signed to a record label. I could start my own because I could actually sell music directly to people. I could sell it out of my living room, which is what I did for a long time. And when people who were trying to make music for kids and get people to know about it, instead of just like playing at a library and selling 10 cassettes or 10 CDs at the end of their show, they were actually able to share their music online, have people hear it, play it for their kids. Their kids get hooked, people can buy it from them. And so suddenly there was this huge surge of really good musicians making music for kids. A lot of them already were making other music, but then they ended up having children and realized, like, hey, there's not a lot out there that I want to listen to. So they started making it themselves, and people found out about it because they didn't have to rely on a record label to actually get that music out there, or a radio station to play the music so that somebody would hear it, right? So that growth happened at the same time. And suddenly there was this like independent group of independent musicians making good music for kids. And that phrase, kindie music, came out of that.
And I think you can include artists like Lisa Loeb in that as well.
Yeah,
and she had a couple of records that she did here in New York.
Right, They Might Be Giants.
They might
have
be
several
giants.
Children's albums. Bare Naked Ladies had Snack Time.
Right,
so I definitely see where that is coming. Now, the part you were focusing on there that I found fascinating was a lot about the indie label. I'm curious what the challenges versus the benefits of owning your own label are, because there has to be some challenges in there, but then there's benefits as well. So I'd like to hear both sides of the scale here.
Yeah. I mean, so originally I really did it for a couple of reasons. I guess one was just that getting signed, there were two things. One is getting signed was hard. When I did try to actually reach out to labels, I remember Rounder Records at the time was one of the only ones. They had Rounder Kids.
Okay. Yep.
And it was also something called New Sounds. There were only a couple of distributors/labels that were really focused on kids' music. And I talked with them before anything happened, before I had any kind of recognition. And they basically said, we think you're only local. Like, we don't think you're actually going to do any better than this. So we're not, you kind of have a local following, but that's not going to grow. So we're not interested. The smaller one, New Sounds, never even called me back. And then when things started happening, like, I don't remember if it was the Today Show or Noggin or whatever, of course, they were all calling me. But at that point, I realized, hey, I got this far by myself. I was trying to get them to help me in the beginning when I really had nothing and I didn't need them. And all that's happening now is that they're saying they're going to take a huge part of the money that I make off of each CD, and I'm just selling them myself. Why do I need them? I don't even need them for marketing. Like, I'm finding my own. I did hire a publicist early on. That was actually, I think that was probably the smartest thing that I did. Like, I mean, running my label was really like me and a friend of mine who I knew, I had known since fourth grade, who was my other tomato of two tomatoes. Sarah Milstein, and she would come over once a week on a Friday afternoon. She was working freelance. I was like, look, I'll pay you $50 every week if you come over and you make me be accountable for my to-do list and maybe help me figure out what I need to do next. And because she was a good writer and selling myself was like the thing I was really the least good at. I was terrified. I would like, my stomach would get in knots when I'd think about having to send a CD to someone to listen to. I didn't want to be reviewed, mostly because I was like, well, I'm writing this for the kids. So I have to send this to some like grown up who's going to sit there and pick apart my music. I don't want to do that. And she would say, okay, you give me that. I'll mail them out and you do these other things, you know? So that was mostly my business until she said like, hey, you need to actually have a record label. You're making albums. You're starting to sell them. You have to keep track of it. You have to like pay taxes and stuff. Yeah.
And Lori, you did the recording in your house, in your apartment, right?
No, the recording. No. Okay. The first one, I did it at a friend's apartment and he was a jazz musician who also kind of dabbled in recording. And this was before Pro Tools came out. My fourth album, we finished it on Pro Tools when it was just starting to come out. We Are the Dinosaurs was on 1-inch.
Yep.
All right.
I was just going to say, you went old school. You went with the reel-to-reels.
So that means we should be expecting a vinyl release soon using the analog sound?
New joke, but wait.
Oh, that's amazing. Right. I love it.
Psyched.
I love it.
I mean, and it's funny to say I went old school. Like, it wasn't old school. That's all that there was.
That's all there was.
That was school.
I was
that
was true. Man, yeah.
Chromium dioxide.
And it was like he lived in Weehawken and had a part of the bottom floor of his apartment. He had turned into a little studio and I would go there and like sing and play at the same time. I mean, like, it was so guerrilla and grassroots.
But that's kind of the entrepreneurial part of all this, which I find absolutely fascinating, is because you didn't just go up and play and have this whole team behind you. You were the team besides your partner with the label. So the entrepreneurial aspect of that is absolutely fascinating.
Well, so there was a little bit more of this story to that. Because I was teaching I was teaching at a few different schools, but at the Westside Y, the person who was in charge of the programming there said, you know, you keep saying that parents are coming to you and saying, what are these songs that my kids are singing? We don't know them because I was writing them. And she was like, you should record your music and I would help you do that if you want to do that. And you could like sell it to the parents. And I said, okay. And I went away and I thought, how cheaply can I do this? Mm-hmm. And I, you know, this was a friend of a friend who had this recording studio. And I thought, if I can get them to give me $2,500 to record it, I'll make I'll make 500 cassettes. And if I sell them all for $5 a piece, that's $2,500. If they give me the $2,500 and it only cost me $2,000 to make it, and I sell all the cassettes, then I'll walk away with $500. And I'm like, I just brought that in. I was like, this is my proposal. And she said, great, I'll give you the money. And as you pay me back, you know, the whatever it was, whatever I just said it, I ended up paying her back. And that doesn't work out though, does it? Somehow I made $500 and I gave her money, I guess. And I ended up selling them so fast that then I could make more of them, right?
That's
like
great.
I took 500 and added another 500 to it. And I made 500 more cassettes and I sold all of those. Like within a year, I had already sold a whole bunch of them because I was not only selling them to the parents, but then people who were hiring me to do birthday parties, they were saying, come and do my kid's birthday party. And do you have something that we can use in like a goodie bag or something? And
I thought, oh, brilliant.
So I didn't have to bring a card or anything. I just brought the cassette. Every kid at the party who wasn't necessarily in my class would go home with my music. And then those parents would call me to do their kids' parties because their kids loved the song so much. So that was a lot of how the early, like, I mean, not well thought out, but that was my entrepreneurial.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are in the presence, if you are just joining us, we are in the presence of Lori Berkner, who can only be described as a genius.
Yeah.
Non-thinking genius.
So we talked a little bit about the vinyl resurgence. We kind of hinted at that. We talked about CDs. But how has streaming services and downloads and digital media kind of affected and impacted what children's music songwriting has done and how that path impacted the kindy rock?
Yeah, that's such a great question because it's been an amazingly roller coaster kind of an experience. So I've been doing this. Well, my first album, that What Do You Think of That? I made that in 1997. And I was, you know, writing music a little before that. It took me a few years before I made that first album. So more than 20 years. And in that time, obviously, we went from cassette to CD to streaming or digital download and then streaming. And people are still buying CDs. But there was a period where selling CDs was really what fueled my business, because especially because I was doing it myself, I had very little overhead. CDs didn't cost that much.
Right.
I was promoting myself through being on television, and it was very easy to sell a lot of product that way. And then even when I stopped being Jack's Big Music Show, only went for 2 seasons, I did a few more videos and I've done other things since then. But that like big time where there were really not that many places for kids to see a lot of kids' content on a screen, like it was really concentrated in Nick Jr., Disney Jr., and PBS, what was PBS Sprout at the time. That all coincided with a lot of people buying a lot of CDs. And then suddenly we had not only the recession, but all the streaming and digital change, right? So when that happened, I feel like people stopped buying CDs, and then they also realized I don't have to buy a CD because I can get it in a different way. It wasn't even just monetarily what was going on in our economy. So it all happened at the same time, and suddenly the bottom dropped out of selling CDs. And people who are doing that, and we're all making CDs, we all still make them. I mean, I think most people do. Some people do on-demand CDs.
Right.
So that still exists. People are still buying them, but I'm selling like a tenth or a fifth. I mean, a half of a 20th. I mean, so many fewer than I ever was before. And when that first happened and the bottom dropped out of the market and the CDs stopped selling, streaming was not really regulated. People didn't think to stream kids' music. I think they were just kind of like, well, I don't have a CD player in my car anymore. So I don't want to buy new CDs, but they weren't necessarily like hooked into Amazon Music or Apple Music or Spotify or however they listen now.
Right.
So it was like some years, and my business really suffered a lot around that time. I both wasn't really on TV that much, and trying to make a living as a musician had become really difficult, and at least for someone my size. Slowly, though, we've been starting to see that trend is changing. People are actually streaming a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, last week, is it weekly? I get reports weekly. Only on Amazon, last week, I had 1.7 million streams of my songs.
Wow.
Right? So there's
deservedly so.
Yes.
Yeah. It's, I mean, people are really listening, and they're really, and kids listen to music over and over again. So in a way, like, kids' music had a lot of the best of both worlds of everything. Like with CDs, those were the last people. They're the last people who are still buying CDs are people who have kids because they want to give a thing, right?
I had to raise my hand when she said that because my daughter knows what CDs are. I have almost 2,500 of them. And it's very much a story that we've told on this podcast many a times where we say, for the musicians out there, if you want to support a band or you want to support an artist that you care about their music, we've said to buy directly from the artist, buy the CDs, But hearing that story is kind of a different take on that. So I'm blown away because.
Yeah, I will say that I think the equation that they use is 1500 streams equals one album. So the difference is with the albums, you get the money up front, right? Someone pays $10, buys your album. You've sold it. You have that money. You have, if they're streaming, you have to wait for them to listen to it over and over and over and over again. So you hope you have songs that they want to listen to over and over and over again. So I think that's one aspect that, you know, if you end up making something that isn't as popular as you want it to be, that could be difficult. But on the other hand, they can still keep listening and they keep paying you a tiny, tiny bit. But those tiny bits, they really do add up. And you can also, they can go back and have Spotify pay me or Amazon pay me for someone to listen to something that I put out 20 years ago, right? And I don't have to house all of that plastic. I don't have to warehouse it. I don't have to pay to ship it to them. I don't have to pay to make it. Like all of those things, there's a give and take. I mean, certainly, again, you have to be able to get people to listen. And that is, you know, in our attention focus, like paying for attention in our economy, it's hard. And honestly, it also turned, I think it comes back to like getting yourself on playlists, which is sort of the same thing as what used to be getting your CD on an end cap at the end of an aisle at Target or something.
Definitely.
Where, you know, it's like all of those same things where now we're sort of vying for spots for people to hear things. But I do think it's a viable way to make a living if you're, you know, if you can get people to listen.
I want to change gears a little bit here. As we were doing show prep for this interview, I was talking with my wife, who is, like I said earlier, is the one who introduced me to your music. And she is a 20-year preschool teacher. And as a parent and as a teacher, she hears a song like The Story of My Feelings as a very honest song for children. And it touches on things that not a lot of children's songs, at least that she has heard in the classroom over the years, touches on, like sadness and anger. What drives you to write about emotions other than happy-go-lucky all the time? Because that is a very real thing to sing for kids, and it's something very different.
I think it's a lot of things. I mean, so you mentioned before I graduated from college and then I started blah, blah, blah. Well, I graduated as a psych major, and I thought I was going to maybe go into psychology. I wasn't sure. I ended up doing a lot of therapy myself instead of being the therapist. I left that to my husband. And I think that in like that process of self-discovery, being conscious of like having feelings being a positive thing and not always having been given that message, or maybe not always having gotten that message, I will say, when I was a kid, took me many years to undo. And a lot of what I write about, I try to write thinking about what I wished I had been able to hear, sing about, dance to, enjoy, learn, feel when I was a kid. And so that's one of those things. And that song, actually, I wrote that I was having a fight with my other tomato. And I just came home and I was like crying about it and I didn't know what to do. And I just sat down on my coffee table and I picked up the guitar and I just started to, like, this is the story of when I cried. I was just like crying and crying and crying. And then, but I was also in this very intense body-based therapy where the whole thing was like, have your feelings, express your feelings. If you hold them back, all you're doing is, it's like toxic, basically, and not to dump them on people, but to be honest about having them be expressed, right? So I was like, I'm crying and it feels good. There's that feeling, you know, when you're a kid, and I think this goes into adulthood when we don't allow ourselves to cry enough. When you start crying, what's so scary about it is that it feels like it will never end, right? It's like, it's never going to transform. I will be sad the rest of my life. And it's scary to go deep into those feelings. But if you let yourself go into them and you actually let yourself cry, that's when you can transform them. And so then it's like, okay, I'm crying. Now I'm like, I don't want to be, I feel kind of angry too. You know, like I have other feelings under there. You start to peel away the layers. And then when you feel angry and you let yourself feel angry and express it, then that can transform as well. And you can actually start to feel kind of like joyous about like, hey, I got some good feelings, you know, and then maybe even like take a breath and just kind of be with like, oh, okay, whew, boy, now I feel sort of peaceful. I felt like I kind of went through all of those feelings and it felt really good to do it musically because that's a way that I express myself. So I just thought, why wouldn't a kid want to feel this too? I wish I had been able to do this when I was a kid and someone didn't say to me, don't cry, stop yelling, you know, even when I was happy, you know, don't be so loud, inside voice, you know, that kind of thing. Or even like, how is it okay to be sort of almost meditative as a kid? Oh, you're supposed to be active, get up, move around, jump around. I mean, all those things are important, but you also want to leave space for the other side.
To piggyback off that, a lot of your songs involve and encourage movement and activity. And is that something you plan in advance or does it just happen that way in the songwriting process for kids?
It's both. I mean, sometimes it happens, like some of the old songs, it would happen in the classroom because I would be kind of working with the kids and I would see that they needed to move or I would notice that they were starting to do those things and I would kind of follow it. But also I think about it very much because, you know, if you think about the age of the kids I'm writing for, I know people start playing my music for infants. I was certainly thinking a lot about early toddlers through maybe 6 years old when I was teaching. I was working at the Infant and Toddler Center at Rockefeller University and at their Child and Family Center. So that was my age breadth. And think about like an 18-month-old kid, barely talking, right? Like just starting to form words and stuff, but their whole life they've been moving. Even if it was just learning to roll over or something, like they've been physical longer than they've been verbal at the, like for a lot of my age group. And so that just seems like a natural way to me for kids to connect to music. I also was really interested when I first started out in a pedagogy called Dalcroze Eurythmics, which was the only actually teaching music class that I took. It was sort of like a night school class once a week. And it's the main thing that a takeaway from me, for me, from it was that when you play music, it encourages a certain kind of music movement, I mean, to that music. So if you're playing quickly, kids might, you might show that to them by running, or you might encourage them to run when you're playing quickly. Or if you are playing sort of a ska beat or a reggae beat, that might encourage them to jump. And I incorporated that a lot into what I was doing because it really followed that idea of put it in the music. Don't talk to them so much, just put it in the music and they will respond. And I would see like 7-month-old babies who were just had just learned to sit up. When I would go, bop, 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 they would start like bouncing in their seats. And it was just so natural. It made the music so much more fun too, that I realized, okay, this is how I can connect to them. So I need to think a lot about what kinds of movements can I incorporate into my music whenever I can.
And it ties a little bit back to what you said earlier when your predecessor at the school had told you, manage them. You know, you give them, you give them something to do and they'll do it and they'll enjoy it more as much as you will. I wanted to capitalize on that a little bit too, because you get a lot of times you get where kids' music, they kind of dumb it down. It's kind of, I don't want to insult anybody by using that term, but you use a lot of sound effects and a lot of freneticness, if that's a word, in these songs. Why is it important, do you think, not to dumb down these songs for kids?
One reason is because then it's much harder for adults to listen to and it's harder for me to actually play them. But I felt really honestly like when I would go into the classroom and talk to the kids, when I just talk to them, they're so smart and tuned into themselves and interested and curious. And I felt like I kind of had to learn a new language when I first started working with preschoolers. Like they were talking in a way that I had learned, it's like I had learned to unlearn it. Like, you know, it was sort of the way that I think we all start in their sincerity and sort of raw desire for pleasure and just being in the moment and all of those things. And the way that they interact with each other there was so much vocabulary that I just remember thinking, like, I don't even understand what they're saying to each other. Like, I was so far away from that as a 20 something that I had to kind of like relearn it. And now I totally forgot what your question was.
Well, why do you think it's important not to dumb it down? Right.
Yeah, because they're not dumb, right? It's like, you don't have to dumb it down. They're not dumb. They have less life experience. But that's the difference. It's about growth and learning and developing and changing in that way. Not that we don't start out dumb. And so I just feel like sometimes things being simpler are easier to, it's easier for them to take in individual things and less complex things sometimes, but not always. And also simple things can be beautiful and so powerful, you know, so there's always a crossover. So I think like dumbing something down is just, you know, not giving it the respect it deserves and not respecting them either.
So piggybacking off of that even more is, what do you think goes into the perfect children's song?
We're taking notes, by the way.
Well, I will say that one of the reasons it was much harder for me to write music that was supposed to be for adults, I think, was because there were fewer parameters. So I have an editing problem. I talk a lot. When I start to write something, I just write and write and write and write and write. And it's not necessarily something that you want to read. It's not particularly, doesn't mean it's interesting or good or unrambling. It's just that I have a lot of thoughts and I need to sort of put them all out there and then I edit back. And writing kids' music forced me to edit in a way that I couldn't. I think it's that I'm really bad at making decisions, honestly. Like every time I had to decide, like, well, I kind of want to write about this, maybe I want to write about that. And then suddenly the song's about 20 different things and then it doesn't mean anything to anybody. Mm-hmm. So when I would write songs for kids, I noticed I got to stick to one idea, or some, if it's more than one idea, they have to be totally integrated and make sense. And if I don't do that, I lose them. You know, I can't do abstract. I have to focus in on what the song is about, like write little nuggets, and not every kid. I mean, when you say what's the perfect kid song, that's like, what's the perfect pop song? What's the perfect jazz song? Like there's so many great ways for a song to be, right? Mm-hmm. There's so many options to make something brilliant and beautiful and catchy and that moves you and, you know, in emotionally and physically, like all those ways. But you have to choose along the way in order to make something like that.
The subjectiveness of it.
Right?
Yeah.
So I would have a very hard time choosing when I did the adult stuff. I was much more sort of Joni Mitchell, diary-like, you know, long things. And some people really liked those songs, but they weren't the same kind of... Well, I think of my songs more honed now. When I first started writing them, I mean, We Are the Dinosaurs, I just walked around and I was like, what do you think of that? They make the earth flat. I mean, I remember thinking, this is the dumbest song. Why would anybody listen to this song? Why does anybody think this is a good song? And then I noticed like, okay, maybe it's not so dumb. I just feel that way about every song that I write. I often feel like I'm writing them and I get really excited by it. And then once it's done, I'm like, oh, it seemed so good when I was writing it. And now... But then I have to put it out in the world and actually get some response from people and make it real that way, because I always go through that process. Like, I like it when I write it, and especially if it's like when with kids around, because there's so much excitement and happiness and they loved it. You know, they begged me for that song over and over again. But then when I sat down and actually looked at the lyrics written out, I was like, who wrote this?
Well, now I have to switch roles from podcast host to parent here. And I will say that We Are the Dinosaurs probably had more collective plays in my car over a 10-year period than probably all of Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and everything else combined. So
no, I can totally take it back. It's a great song. I'm sorry that
But I have a few questions about some of your other songs. Now, this is coming just from a parent. I need to know. It'll help me sleep better at night. Who is Victor Vito and Freddie Vasco? Because I know what they eat, but I want to know who these people are. What's the story behind them?
So when I first started, I guess maybe when I first started my business, I got an accountant and his name was Fred Fishkin, Freddy. And then I stayed with him for a while and doing my taxes was probably the most stressful thing in my world at all times. Like I didn't understand sales tax and all that, like all this stuff about starting a business. I was honestly was like, what am I doing? And so Fred was not helping me enough. So I moved on to Vito Sclafani of Vasco Accounting. And I thought his name was Vito Vasco for like a year. And I was like, Fred Fishkin and Vito Vasco? How do I get only alliterative accountants? Alliterative accountants? Like even that's alliteration. And I just thought it was so funny. Then I found out his name was actually Vito Sclafani. But I remembered thinking, God, that those names are really fun to say. And that's part of, that's one thing that I love writing songs. I love writing songs when there's like fun things to say. And I loved that when I was a kid. So literally like 3 years after I think I had even left Vito at that point, I still remembered their names and I was walking to work and I didn't have a new song that day. And I was like, I should, what about that Vito Vasco, Freddy Fishkin, Victor Vito, Freddy, I just started blah, 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 blah. And by the time I'd walked from the subway to the school, I had come up with Victor Vito and I was like, okay, that's kind of fun to say. Let's see what happens. So I played it for the kids there. And while I was there, if you know the song, by the third verse, it gets slower and then it gets faster at the end. And I was playing the song and I had them do the call and response. But then I felt like, oh, maybe they're getting bored. I got to do something different. So I slowed it down. And then I was like, oh, once you slow it down, you got to speed it up. And then that everybody got up and started dancing. And I thought, oh, this is working. But there was one kid who said, I can't say, all the words are too hard for me. And I thought, oh, maybe it is too hard. Maybe I shouldn't leave this song as it is. And I sort of set it aside. And then the next week when I saw her, she had been trying to learn it. And I thought, oh, no, that's good. You don't want to just like get it and then be done. Like you have to work for some of this stuff. But if she cared enough to actually want to learn it, and she was only three, like that was good. So anyway, that was the story of Victor Vito and Freddy Vasco.
That's awesome.
All right. I've been waiting 10 years for that answer. That's fantastic.
A couple of times you've dropped Jack's Big Music Show, which by the way was my favorite. That show introduced my two older children into the world of music with Little Sock Puppet. If you haven't seen this show, is the cutest little dog sock puppet and his friends, and they had this treehouse. And his mom would always, the funny thing, Laurie, about Jack's Big Music Show is what she would always tell him she was going out to do that particular day.
Right.
And it was always something random and different and funny that the kids wouldn't get it, but the adults would totally get it.
Yep, yep.
And that's when Laurie Berkner popped onto my TV and I was just, I'm like, this is amazing. This is fun. This is, it's poppy, it's catchy, and it's informative, like it's educational. I want to know for you, because before that you were doing, you know, live concerts and parties. What was that transition like for you to go to the TV, jumping in media for all intents and purposes?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, when we, like I said, we started just by doing those 4 or 5 videos for Noggin. It was interesting because we shot them all in one day and the first round of them were terrible. Like, I don't know what happened, but they actually fired that production company and said, we're going to redo all of them. And I remember feeling like I was going to die at the end of that day. Like, I was so tired and exhausted and so unhappy. And I thought, is this what is this going to be like? You know, like, this is awful. And then we rescheduled and shot them again. And it was great. It was actually, it was awesome. And I will say, those first Noggin videos, if I have the timing right, I was 2 months pregnant and I was lying down on the set, yep, in between the shots, trying not to throw up.
Oh, man, that's a behind the scenes moment there.
But I will say, now, if you haven't seen any of these videos or Laurie's brilliant turns on Jack's Big Music Show or any of the Noggin stuff, for a minute, I had no idea that you didn't have a TV background.
Yeah, well, I did have an acting. I mean, when I was in high school, I really wanted to be on Broadway. That was like my fantasy. So I had the lead for in junior and senior year in my, like in the musical at high school and, or one of the leads. And I loved acting, but I didn't really like having to be a character that wasn't me is what I realized. Like I like being on stage and playing music and talking to people and just like blah, 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 you know, but when I had to memorize lines and try to do something else, I actually, there were some things about that I really liked, but eventually I realized I didn't like it as much as just getting up and making music. But I think the acting background really helped because that's where you learn to take direction, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. learn what kinds of things, like watch other people who do it. And I would think about like, oh, you know, what do I do that's good for me? Like what feels good when I'm in the audience? What is that person doing that makes me feel like they're really talking to me? And so that when I'm up there, I can do the same thing because I want to be talking to everybody, but it doesn't always, like how what a person feels on stage is certainly very different than being the person watching, right? And so I just tried to do that into a camera and it worked. I mean, people did, I feel like that has made it's been a very big part of the reason why people got to hear my music was that I was somehow able to translate not just being a musician, but also someone that you'd want to like, think you would want to talk to, or mm-hmm. like, I think the kids feel that way when they see the music, that they feel comfortable seeing me. Even now when I make my videos, I think really a lot about like, I'm looking at kids right now. Like I am imagining them, interacting with them, you know, but even though it's just a camera in front of me, I really try to be in that space. And luckily it seems to translate. And I know it doesn't always for everybody. So that's just been something that, you know.
You don't see the questions we have over here, do you? No. You had mentioned something in your last question that was literally the next question I had queued up. So thank you so much for the perfect segue.
Yes. No problem.
Besides the albums that you've written, you've also done music for off-Broadway plays. And you talked about this background in acting and off-Broadway. Do you ever feel that there was a difference in writing for off-Broadway music as to the children's songs that you put on your albums? Is there a different mindset and a different path that you need to take with that style of music?
Yes and no. I mean, yes, in that when I'm writing a song that's part of a musical, it has to move the story along. It has to give a certain amount of information. When I'm writing a kid's song that doesn't have to do with anything else, I just decide like what kind of information I want to put into the song, right? So in a way, though, that's really good for me because, again, it gives me limitations. I really work better when someone says, I want a song like this. I need you to get this information into the song. I want this to happen by the end of it. Like I write a lot of songs without people telling me what to write, but I've noticed when people give me parameters like that, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do that. I'm going to figure out how to make that a good song. It's like a puzzle. Like I love crossword puzzles. And so I get really excited and I feel like, writing the music for those three, we did Wanda's Monster, which was based on the book called Wanda's Monster. Mm-hmm. And that was hard because I had to write a lot of songs with the word monster in it. Although we did use my song Monster Boogie, which was helpful because that was already written. And then I had to write songs for a book that was about mimes. Oh, mimes who speak.
Instrumental album, was it?
we decided to do scatting. Like the parents who, when they didn't speak, they were like, hoobabadooba, scoobadoobadoo, you know, like that was sort of how, but they only did that in when they were singing and then they didn't speak for other parts of the show.
So clever.
And then, yeah, that might not have been my idea. And the last one was a futuristic feminist take on Cinderella, which was Interstellar Cinderella. So that was all like songs about 1,000 years in the future, which was sort of somehow became kind of retro and futuristic at the same time, which was fun. But so those were like, it's not things that I would like sit around thinking I should write about, or like a song for the stepmother or something, which was super fun to write. That song was called Little Miss Fix It. And it was where she was like complaining about Cinderella being, and a little, you know, a goody two shoes and her kids being so much better. So anyway, it was really, it's fun and it's different in that way. But I had to write like a song that did a certain thing and fit in the musical and hopefully was easy enough on the ears for kids to want to immediately get connected to it and want to go home and sing it, but also sophisticated enough that adults wouldn't be like, oh, I'm listening to a musical filled with songs like Old MacDonald, right? So it's sort of had the same, I had some of the same challenges.
Aside from those off-Broadway shows, you have some Audible original series, Lori Berkner's Song and Story Kitchen, and in that also into Sirius XM's Kids Place Live. You did a show with your daughter, and I know you've mentioned your husband was the bass player in the original Lori Berkner band. Tell me a little bit about how what that's like for you doing shows with your family members and how it's like to work with your own family.
Well, Brian left the band. I mean, it was great. We were playing together before Lucy was born, and she is 14 now. So we did that mostly because he had taken a job. He also was a psychology major, ended up going into computers and was kind of making some money while I was teaching and trying to start my business. And that helped us for a while. And then luckily we got to flip it when then I started suddenly doing really well. And he was like, I can quit my computer job and come play music with you and we can support ourselves on your music. So we did that for a while until Lucy was born and then was about a year and a half, which was when he said, you know what? I love playing music, but I never planned on being a musician. And I know that writing kids' music is really your passion and it's not really mine, even though I really love playing with you. I need to go do what I want to do. So he then took the next 8 years and got a PhD in psychology. And so he's, and a master's. So he's doing that now, which is awesome. And it was really hard. I actually thought what was hard was him leaving. I actually thought that I would quit. I was like, who else am I going to play with? Like, who's going to want to play with me? And who else would I get? And then some other people convinced me, like, you could probably get somebody else.
And then the show on XM with Lucy, who you said was 14. So that's about the same age as Sydney. And yeah. Sydney started watching you apparently when you were 2 months pregnant with Lucy. So that's terrific.
Yeah, well, that's we haven't done that in some years now, but she did that with me for many years. I'm trying to remember how old she was. She might have been 5 or 6 when we started and then did it until she was like 8 or 9 or 10, maybe even. We did it for a lot of years and it was we would go in once a month and we would record the whole month in one sitting. And all we would do was talk about how each day it morphed a little bit over time, but each day was special. It was like it's National Cupcake Day, or it's like, you know, and or it would be like a birthday shout out or something. We would like do shout outs. People would send in their birthdays for that day and we'd be like, it's National Cupcake Day and it's Brian and Jay's birthday.
All right. Yeah. I'm all excited.
And Lucy was like the most cool improv partner. It was so awesome. And she would just be like, Mom, do you have a favorite cupcake? Because mine is blah, blah, or whatever. Sure, she's like, I think we should ask people who are listening about their favorite cupcakes. And in fact, if we were making cupcakes, I would make mine blue and green. And like, she would just like say stuff. And then we'd be like, okay, happy National Cupcake Day. We just made it up, every single one of them. And she was such a good sport about it. Because sometimes we'd go there and it was like 7 o'clock at night. And she was 6 years old and like exhausted and hungry. And it was raining outside. And she'd be like, do I have to do this with you? And other times I'd say, you don't have to do this at all. And then she'd be like, no, I want to, you know, she got really into it. And then after a few years, she finally said, I think I'm done. And she started sounding older, which wasn't as fun, I think, you know? But she's always been, she's been really great about being part of what I do. When she was super little, she was backstage and I was breastfeeding her, you know, in between shows. And when she got older, she would come down front and watch the show. And then that was not her favorite time because I didn't respond to her like calling out, hey, mom, I have a question, you know. And then she started like coming and throwing beach balls out of the audience from the shows, or singing sometimes on stage, or now she likes to sell merch, you know, at the shows and helps that way. And I'll say she's actually good at performing, but I don't think it's her. She doesn't love it. She loves being around the theater. So she's been really interested in like technical theater and set design and costumes and stuff. And she said, it's your fault, mom. I feel like I grew up going to theaters all the time, being backstage all the time. I feel so comfortable there. But I don't really want to get up in front of people all the time.
That's amazing, though. Now, there may be some future musicians listening to this podcast. So I would like to know if you have any advice that you'd like to give to younger up-and-coming artists that have an interest in the kindy scene, so to speak. What advice would you give for someone who, dare I would say, is a veteran and at the top of the game of this genre?
I think the thing that I felt like really helped me get to a place where I was happy in what I was doing was doing what made me happy. So if you're listening and making music for kids makes you feel good and you enjoy it, then just keep doing it and keep paying attention to what it is that's working. I think I said it once in the interview already, like just I was following kind of what was working for me. And to me, that's pretty much the same thing as what makes me happy. Like if it's working, then usually I'm feeling pretty good about it. It's not always true for everybody, but I do think that if you have both of those things, like you notice, oh, this really like helps me connect to kids and I really like doing it. Okay, let's do some more of that. Let's just keep following what works for you, because I think the path is so changing so quickly. Like the way, like we were talking about how people consume music, all of that changes so fast. If you have that core of like, this is what something that I love and that I feel like I'm good at. If you can put those two things together and follow them, then you can kind of weather whatever changes around you, right? So I think that's really a good place to start from anyway.
Brilliant. Awesome. Lori yep. Berkner, this has been an absolute pleasure from a parent, from a radio perspective. Thank you for all the music you've provided to us and our families over the years. And thank you so much for being a part of our episode this evening.
Oh, thank you. It really was totally my pleasure.
And once again, if you enjoyed what you were hearing in this episode, check out HBO Max's Music Box, Happy and You Know It, for an in-depth look at the world of children's music. If you like what you're hearing on My Weekly Mixtape, be sure to send me an email, myweeklymixtape@gmail.com. Let me know what future episodes you would like to hear on the show. You can also hit me up on social media at My Weekly Mixtape. You can use the contact page over at myweeklymixtape.com, or you can join the Mixtaper community at patreon.com/myweeklymixtape. It's free to join, and there's several tiers there if you'd like to support the show a little extra, but none of that is expected. I just appreciate any support you can show for the show, which includes, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube, please leave a 5-star review or a comment so that way other music fans can discover the show, because, you know, algorithms. And if you'd like to explore the entire back catalog of My Weekly Mixtape, you can do so over at myweeklymixtape.com. My name is Brian Colburn. This has been My Weekly Mixtape. And until next time, enjoy the tunes.